This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Have you ever heard of bliss points? It's a term food scientists use as they design the meals you eat in restaurants or pluck from the freezer section of your supermarket or grab at the gas station cash register. The goal is to make that food more than just tasty, to make it irresistible. Former FDA chief David Kessler says our brains have been captured and we've got to retake control. This hour on Point, David Kessler on controlling the American appetite. You can join the conversation. Do you remember a time when eating was about three squares and that was it? Do you feel surrounded by an ocean of food products, all in shiny wrappers and big colorful menus? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Dr. David Kessler. He was commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration from 1990 to 97 under the first President Bush and then President Clinton. During his time at the FDA, he led the campaign to regulate tobacco, which led to a landmark lawsuit. He also led a campaign for stricter food labeling, once famously ordering 24,000 gallons of orange juice seized because it was labeled fresh but was actually from concentrate. By training, he is a pediatrician and a lawyer. He is the author of the new book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Dr. Kessler, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
This book started while you were watching an episode of Oprah. Tell us what caught your attention.
There was a woman on the show I was watching, very well educated, very well dressed, very articulate. And I remember listening. She said that she ate when her husband left for work in the morning. She ate before he came home at night. She ate when she was happy. She ate when she was sad. She ate when she was hungry. She ate when she was not hungry. And then she said, I don't like myself. And I was trying to listen. Listen as a physician, as a clinician. Because I could relate. I have suits in every size. And I was trying to understand what was driving this woman to do what she didn't want to be doing, knew she didn't want to be doing it, but did it anyway. That was the question. That was the journey for the last 7 years.
Of this incredible journey, this incredible book about overeating and what that means in our country. In your book, you point out for centuries, humans weighed about the same. It was just a few decades ago that things began to change. What happened?
I asked my colleague, Catherine Flagel, one of the great epidemiologists at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. I asked her to share with me how weight changes over our adult years and to go back several decades. And when I was growing up in the 1960s, you entered your 20s, maybe gained a few pounds between 20 and 40, but relatively stable. You then leveled off, maybe lost a few pounds in your 60s and 70s. But today, you enter your adult years much higher weight. So much of the weight gain is happening in childhood and adolescence. But what's most concerning is that when you enter your adult years, you continue to gain weight. It doesn't plateau until you're 50 or beyond. So there is a dramatic change in our weight gain over our adult years, something we didn't see just decades ago.
a dramatic change, to be sure. I'm looking at the big study that was released just yesterday measuring obesity in this country. Obesity rates among adults rose in 23 states just last year. No state experienced a significant decline. The study calls obesity an epidemic. In your book, Dr. Kessler, you say the food industry is hijacking the brains of millions of Americans. What have you learned about how they are using fat and sugar and salt and how it's affecting us?
Let me give you, Jane, a few pieces of the science, and just let's go through that, and then we can put the puzzle together. Vanilla milkshake. We just published a paper with my colleagues at the University of Washington, not the usual scientific title of a paper. It's called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. What do you think it is about that vanilla milkshake that drives intake? You think it's the sugar, it's the fat, or the flavor? What's your guess?
The flavor.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's the sugar. Mm. The sugar is the main driver. But when you add fat to that, it's synergistic. It drives more consumption. Then with my colleague, Gaetano Di Chiara, one of the great pharmacologists in Italy. Gaetano has always studied drugs. He studied amphetamine, cocaine, and he sees that when you administer those drugs, there are changes in the levels of dopamine in the neural systems. What does dopamine do? It focuses your attention. It locks in your brain, and that's what we always thought. You know, those drugs, that was the mechanism by which they operated. Foods, maybe you got a little bump the first time you were exposed to the food, but you habituated. You didn't see this rise in dopamine. So I said to Gaetano, let's take foods that have not just sugar, not just fat, but sugar and fat. Let's make them highly palatable. And let's see what happens to the dopamine levels. And in fact, we see that there are significant level increases in dopamine, and there's no habituation. There's no decrease. So every time you consume, you get this spike. Mm-hmm. Then I wanted to understand, you know, this woman on Oprah that I was listening to, this woman who had such a hard time resisting eating. I wanted to know how many people were like her. Let me give you three characteristics, three behavioral characteristics. Now, some people, when they hear this, say, you know, I don't know what you're talking about, David. But others, when they hear this, they see themselves. One, a hard time resisting your favorite foods, a loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods. Two, a lack of satiation, a lack of feeling full, a hard time stopping eating. Three, a preoccupation of thinking about foods between meals, or sometimes when you're eating, actually thinking about what you're going to be eating next as you're eating those foods. Those three characteristics, loss of control, lack of satiation, a preoccupation with foods. We're not talking about an eating disorder. But what we see and what we found is that a significant number of people who are obese and overweight, more people who are obese or overweight, have those characteristics. But a significant number of people who are healthy weight also have those characteristics.
And is that because the circuitry of the brain is actually being altered by this fat, sugar, salt combination? The wiring of your brain is actually changing?
Jane, you're exactly right. And that was the missing link. So with my colleague, Dr. Dana Small at Yale University, we studied these individuals, these individuals who have, you know, millions who have this conditioned hypereating, this hard time resisting, and we studied them in the brain scanners. And we did it in two phases. The first phase, just the anticipation of food. Didn't even give them the food, just the smell. Because the power of food comes not only from the taste, it comes from the anticipation, the thoughts of food. And what we saw in these individuals, there's excessive activation of the reward circuits of the brain, of the amygdala. And what was equally interesting is that when they ate the food, when they tasted it, that excessive activation continued and continued until all the food is gone. So we now know, you know, for those people for whom it's so hard to resist food, it's not their fault. Their brains are being excessively activating. And what are their brains being activated by? Fat, sugar, and salt.
And in fact, you say in the book, it's the layering of those things, that there are actually so-called food designers who engineer this food, layer it in a particular way, the salt, fat, sugar, to actually stimulate our appetites, stimulate our brains. And that sets in motion this cycle of overeating.
You're exactly right. Pick a modern American restaurant. Pick an appetizer. Pick buffalo wings, for example. What are they? Well, you take the fatty part of the chicken. They're fried in the manufacturing plant, so you load another 30, 40% fat by weight. They're fried again and usually in the kitchen of the restaurant. That red sauce, what is it? Fat and sugar. That white creamy sauce on the side, fat, sugar, and salt. What are we eating? Fat on fat on fat on fat, sugar, and salt. I used to think that I was eating for nutrition to fill myself up for satisfaction. The fact is, fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt stimulate us to eat more and more.
And in the engineering of the food, I think you call it in the book adult baby food. This is food that is easy to swallow. It doesn't need a lot of chewing, frankly.
It goes down in a whoosh. It's orosensory self-stimulation. Count the number of chews the next time you take a bite of food. Back 20 years ago, it used to be about 20 chews per bite. Today, food goes down in an instant. The food industry understands the inputs. They understand that fat, sugar, and salt stimulate. They understand the outputs, that we come back for more. Have they understood the neuroscience? I don't think so.
You don't?
I'm sorry.
You don't think they do? You don't think they understand the neuroscience?
I think they understood what works. I think they learned experientially. They understood what drives intake. They understood why people come back for more. I think there's no question they design food, they construct food for that optimal stimulation, for that optimal bliss point. Have they understood that our brains are being hijacked? Have they understood the reward circuits? I don't think they've understood that. But they didn't need to understand that to design food to make us come back for more and more.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about overeating this hour and the public health disaster that took off in the 1980s and continues to this day. My guest this hour is Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration and the author of The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Here is an actual TV commercial produced by TGI Fridays. I guess you could call this truth in advertising because it tells the viewer pretty directly how they go about making you order and eating that huge portion with all of its layers of salt and fat and sugar.
This isn't about grabbing a bite. It's about a bite grabbing you. Because when Fridays gets a hold of your appetite, we're not letting go. We're going to bring on the flavor until your taste buds explode like fireworks. We're going to drizzle glazes and pour on smoky salsas. We're going to pan fry, saute, and dream up dishes that have never been created before.
Glazes, sauces, sautés, that's pretty straightforward, Dr. Kessler. I mean, you interview food executives in the book who admit that fat and salt and sugar are indeed the building blocks of successful food products.
What are in those sauces and glazers? They're fat, they're sugar, and salt, and they're just loading it and layering it onto our foods. Understand how this works. I give you a package of sugar and say, go have a good time. And you're going to look at me and say, what are you talking about? Now to that sugar, I add fat. I add texture. I add temperature. I add color. I add flavor. I put it on every corner. I make it available 24/7. I say it's socially acceptable to eat any time. You can do it with your friends. I add the emotional gloss of advertising. You'll love it. You'll want it. What did we expect would happen? We've taken fat, sugar, and salt. The business plan of the modern American food company, take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it into entertainment, make it something you want.
That entertainment, that emotional gloss of advertising that you speak of, from your research, do the people who experience what you call in the book conditioned hypereating, eating all this stuff, the layering of the fat, the sugar, the salt, do they have more pleasure than other people in their eating?
A fascinating question. No, it's not more pleasure. It's not the liking. It's the wanting. Kent Berridge, one of the great neuroscientists in the University of Michigan, has made this distinction between liking and wanting. No, there's no difference in liking, but there's a difference in wanting. Understand, and this is key, our behavior, at least the behavior of millions of Americans, is not only becoming conditioned, but it's becoming conditioned and driven. What do I mean by that? Understand how this cycle of consumption works. We get cued based on past learning, past memories. It could be the sight, it could be the smell, it could be the time of day. When I land in San Francisco airport, as soon as the plane, you know, hits the runway, I start thinking about these Chinese dumplings. Why? Because this is a great place at the food court. The queue, just in that case, the plane. Sometimes it could be the car. You just get in the car and you have these thoughts of wanting. Those thoughts of wanting, those cues activate your brain. They cause arousal. They lock in your attention. You consume. You have that moment of pleasure that's ephemeral. Then you get cued again and you do it again. And every time you get cued, you only strengthen the neural circuits when you eat.
Meaning you're more likely, doctor, then to do it again.
And you're strengthening the neural circuits, and that cue stimulates thoughts of wanting. And remember Pavlov in high school, you know, that bell,
yeah.
You know, and that bell was associated with the food. So those cues, you know, associated, and it drives those thoughts of wanting. But what's key is it's not just involving the learning circuits of the brain. It's involving the learning and motivational circuits of the brain. Because if you try to stop it, once your brain is activated, you know that inner dialogue that many people get? Boy, that looks great. No, I shouldn't have that. Maybe just a little, no, not now. If you try to stop it, once your brain is activated, once you're aroused, once your attention is locked in, and you try to stop it, you understand how difficult it is because those thoughts of wanting, those thoughts only increase your desire for food, increases the reward value. That's the stuff of obsessions. That's the stuff of cravings.
Let's go to the phones because literally I've so many calls lined up here. I want to get him in fast. Wayne is in South Carolina, Columbia. Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Just wanted to jump in with a basic observation.
Okay.
This is kind of a variation on determinism, it seems. You know, you're determined by your nutritional behavior or by the food that's being put out in front of you. I'm certainly not determined by that. So, and I'm not, you know, the victim of any kind of determinism of any kind.
Does that mean you just have better self-control, Wayne? You just take more responsibility for what you put in your mouth?
Well, I just think this fundamental argument of some kind of form of determinism shows up in every profession at some point. And it doesn't escape, you know, the basic idea that we have a choice and we're responsible. And I don't know of any friends or anyone I've ever known who hasn't at some point been able to say, you know, enough's enough, I'm going on a diet. It's more important to me to go on the diet, to lose the weight, to get healthy. It might be hard to make that choice for a variety of factors, some of which, you know, probably is true that the delectability of the food is a factor. But I just don't accept the fundamental idea that these people are, like, able to actually control your behavior.
Wayne, it's a good point. Thanks. Dr. Kessler, respond to Wayne. More emphasis should be placed on individual responsibility.
Fascinating and important observation by Wayne. Let me just explain how it works. We are all wired. It's part of being human to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. What do I mean by the most salient stimuli in our environment? Jane, if a bear came in the studio right now, you would stop talking to me. You know, if your kid is sick, you're thinking about your kid. You know, for some people, it could be alcohol, it could be tobacco, it could be sex, it could be gambling. But for many people, food has become the most salient stimuli. And at that core of that food, it's fat, sugar, and salt. Wayne talks about diets. The fact is, sure, people can lose weight. But why do the vast majority gain it back? Because diets can't work. Once you understand that once the old neural circuitry is laid down, that old learning is there, of course you can lose weight. You know, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, you deprive yourself. But if you haven't laid down new learning, new neural circuitry, on top of that old learning, you get bombarded with the cues. You go back to your environment. You get bombarded with those cues. What do you think is going to happen? Of course you're going to gain weight. Once that neural circuitry gets laid down, you strengthen those circuits that are involved, the learning, motivational, habit, and memory circuits of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The only way to deal with that is to lay down new learning, new circuitry. Now, I agree with Wayne. Right? The fact is, just because our brains are being hijacked, just because our brains are being excessively activated, doesn't mean that we shouldn't, as individuals, take steps to protect ourselves, to fight back.
Well, let me ask you about the personal responsibility as it relates to the food industries themselves, because as you mentioned in the first block, I mean, the food industry knows what it's doing and in some ways is intentionally trying to manipulate our appetites. I mean, you make the comparison to big tobacco, for which you're very familiar and did so much work in the 1990s. You imply that food has the same pull over people that drugs do, that tobacco did. Do you foresee a time, as the former FDA chief, do you foresee a time when the food industry will be held financially accountable for obesity-related diseases?
Back 40, 50 years ago, in the face of evidence that smoking caused cancer, what did the tobacco industry do? They denied the evidence, they created doubt, and they deceived the American public. We now have the science to show that fat, sugar, and salt being loaded and layered into our food is conditioning and driving the behavior, not only of us, but of our kids. Leave aside what the food industry has known. The issue is now that we know that the behavior of millions of Americans are becoming conditioned and driven by the food industry. The question is, what are we going to do? Does the food industry have to change? Absolutely. Does government have a greater role for education and disclosure? Absolutely. But again, we as individuals need to take steps to protect ourselves. But
so you don't. So you don't see them becoming financially accountable at some point in the future for these extraordinary obesity rates that we're seeing in this country?
Financial accountability? I'm not sure. But I do think we have an obligation. With this massive increase in obesity, the consequences are so profound. You know, back 10 years ago, there were 4 cases of type 2 diabetes per 1,000. Type 2 diabetes, I could just as well write obesity in the medical chart. Mm-hmm. Today, there are 9 cases per 1,000. We spent in the year 2000 $7 billion on drugs for type 2 diabetes. Today we're spending $13 billion on drugs for diabetes. We all want healthcare reform. How are we going to be able to pay for this unless we are able to get the excessive eating under control?
When you, Dr. Kessler, took on the big tobacco, you in fact demonized that industry. You changed the image of the industry. Do you plan that same kind of national campaign with food, and can you do that with food?
If you look at the success that we've had in public health, in tobacco, how have we had that? You know, we haven't until this last week, until President Obama signed the historic piece of legislation giving FDA the ability to regulate tobacco. There wasn't regulation. There wasn't legislation. But what's been the success over the last several decades? How did we achieve that? Tobacco 20, 30, 40 years ago, how did we view the product? It was a reinforcing product, and the industry, you know, did everything it was possible to make it socially acceptable, to make it glamorous, to make it sexy, something that you wanted. What was the success? We changed the product. We changed how the product, not the product, but we changed how the product is viewed from something you wanted to something that now we look at as a deadly, disgusting, addictive product. Now, tobacco is easy because you can live without tobacco. Food we need. But until we change our perception, if you look at that huge plate of fries and say, that's my friend, I want that, that's going to make me feel better. There's nothing I can do to get between you and that huge plate of fries. We have to change how we view food. We need a critical perceptual shift. We have to change what scientists call the valence of the product. We used to view cigarettes as positive. We view it as negative. Now,
food, we still has to be pleasurable. It's essential. We deprive ourselves. It's not going to work. Diets are not going to work. But we have to, this big food, this food that is layered and loaded with fat, sugar, and salt, if you look at that and say, that's my friend, we're just going to continue on the trajectory we are.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Bob is on the line from Macomb, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Bob. Thanks for waiting.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We try to make intelligent decisions. We've gotten rid of refined sugar in our diet at home and everything else. And when we go out, I'll skip the French fries. But there's one thing I've noticed with, like, Arby's roast beef sandwiches. You buy one of these things, and you almost have to inhale it. Because you're so driven, you're not even taking a breath of air. There's something in these sandwiches that just make you devour them so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost scary.
Mm-hmm. You felt it. You've experienced what Dr. Kessler is speaking about. Bob, thanks so much for the call. Here's Valerie. She's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Tomorrow is 2.5 years sober from sugar for me.
Mm.
And it has completely changed my life. I've dieted off and on my whole life, and getting rid of sugar and flour has not just given me freedom from 40 extra pounds. What it's done is stopped the obsessions, the compulsions in my head. And I want to give a shout out to Overeaters Anonymous because it's the fellowship, and it's based on the 12 steps of AA. It's the only thing that's ever changed my life.
Mm. No more cravings. Your brain has actually changed. Valerie, so interesting. Thanks so much. Dr. Kessler, a response?
I think Valerie said it more eloquently than I could ever say it. Fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt, they stimulate us to eat more and more. And I agree. I think Overeaters Anonymous, the support that one gets, the fellowship, the fact that it makes clear what the rules are, it takes the anxiety out, it provides support. Valerie is a terrific example of success. And most importantly, you know, the fact is, you know, we tend to think, you know, we're free will, free choice. But when your brain is being activated, when those reward circuits are being lit up, if you would, it's very hard to control what you eat.
Mm.
And that's what we're seeing. Once we understand as a nation that our behavior of millions of Americans is becoming conditioned and driven, it's not just genetic, it's not just our physiology. We're conditioning and driving the behavior of millions of Americans and our kids. That has profound implications. And what's driving it? It's that fat, sugar, and salt on every corner that we've made into entertainment.
What about restaurant eating? You know, we played the TGIF's ad there before, but how important is disclosure, extending food labels to restaurants?
I think it's very, very important. I think it's the key step. Someone in the food industry said to me, Kessler, you know, this obesity epidemic is your fault. And I said, what are you talking about? Said, when you were at FDA, you did a good job of that nutrition facts panel. You know that information, that little black box on all processed foods in the supermarket? Said, you did a good job. You put that on everything in the supermarket. That not only affects consumers' behavior, but it affects the industry's behavior because they don't want to look bad on that label, so they change their products and they have some boundaries. What you didn't do was you didn't put that label on restaurant foods, and that's where it exploded.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about taking control of our insatiable appetites in this country, understanding why our society has gone from 3 square meals to life in a theme park of restaurants, supermarkets, and convenience stores. My guest this hour is Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration under the first President Bush and President Clinton, and the author of the new book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite.
Here is a McDonald's commercial that we found from 1978 that describes lovingly how a Big Mac is built and about its mysterious quality of making you order one after another. By the way, this commercial came just as the huge national epidemic in obesity was just taking off.
There's something about a Big Mac that keeps you coming back. Keeps you coming back. Back to that Big Mac. Is it the two? All beef patties, special sauce, lettuce and cheese. All the pickles and onions on the bun. Could it be those sesame seeds?
To be fair, Dr. Kessler, McDonald's has tried to add healthy alternatives and additions to their menus. Are those healthy additions good enough?
They're a start. You know, look, I'm not the food purist. You know, you don't want to get your nutrition information just from me, but I don't have a problem. You want to eat a hamburger? That's fine. But when that 400 or 500 calorie hamburger, you know, becomes 1,000, becomes 1,500, that's where I have the problem. Look at the current ads for McDonald's. Look at any ad for food tonight on TV. Do they talk about the nutritional value of the food? No. Sometimes it's the economic value. But most of the time, the taglines are, you'll love it, you'll want it. They add the emotional gloss of advertising. What have we done? What have we done in this country? What's been the real change over the last several decades? Sure, my grandmother cooked with fat and sugar. Look at the French. The French, you know, ate highly palatable foods, but they would eat only during meals. The French would never walk down the streets eating. They would never eat at business meetings. They would never eat in their car. That was not socially acceptable.
So they had structured eatings. They had barriers around their food experience. Let me ask you, Dr. Kessler, about children, because there is a lot of concern, obviously, about obesity and kids. What is the biggest cause of that? Is it portions that are too large? Is it the wrong types of food that they're eating?
You just mentioned barriers. There are no barriers. Let me give you one piece of data. Two-year-olds. Two-year-olds compensate for their eating. What do I mean? You give them more calories at lunch, they eat fewer calories later in the day. By the time they're 4 or 5, they lose the ability to compensate. Hmm. Children eat through, these children are eating throughout the day. They never experience a moment of hunger. They're eating constantly. We've taken down all the barriers. We're eating constantly, and what are we eating? Fat, sugar, and salt, breakfast, lunch, dinner, throughout the day, 24/7.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Niagara Falls, New York. Mark is on the line. Mark, thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that in around about 1960, my father lost his job, and there was no food stamps then, but there was federal food aid, and what we got was dried beans, cheese.
Hmm.
We got real food.
Mm-hmm.
And now I stand behind somebody in the checkout that are receiving food stamps, and I see they're buying sugar, frosted, whatever, I don't mean to name brand names. They're buying
junk food.
Sort of food that the doctor's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think we should be subsidizing it. Not to be a meanie. I mean, I like everybody to have a treat. It's just not good food, and you can buy all sorts of terrible nutritional stuff on food stamps.
Mark, thanks so much. I appreciate your comment. Thank you very much for calling, sir. Andy is now next. She's in Beverly, Massachusetts. Andy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Dr. Kessler, thank you so much for writing this book. I've been working for the past 3 years trying to get the school lunch changed at my daughter's school. It's plays into all that stuff you're talking about. Nothing is fresh food. It's all heat and serve food that enters that kitchen, highly processed. They keep coming back at me with, oh, we meet federal guidelines. We know that the food industry influences the USDA guidelines. And I just want to know what your comments are about school lunch program and what's your advice to me on how to make the school lunch healthier.
Hmm. Andy, thanks.
Keep up the good work. Keep up that good work. Once we know, you know, that our behavior of our kids, I mean, we have the science now, their behavior is becoming conditioned and driven for a lifetime. And it's being conditioned and driven
by the foods, the fat, sugar, and salt, and the food cues. That has profound implications for public policy. School lunches? The fact is we're serving our kids fat, sugar, and salt. That's conditioning them for a lifetime. Does that have to change? Absolutely. The implications for vending machines? Absolutely. What we subsidize with our tax dollars, the farm subsidies? Absolutely. Those things need to change. You know, I think we're going to start to see, I mean, it's happening. I think we're going to start to see a movement back toward real food. You know, my colleagues, Michael Pollan, Alice Waters, you know, I was a little concerned at first that maybe it sounded a little elitist. You know, that stuff was more expensive. How are we going to all afford it? But the food we're eating is so processed. It's pre-digested.
Yeah, but there is a segment of the population, Dr. Kessler, that just does not have access to healthy food alternatives. I mean, really.
Why are we subsidizing fat and sugar and high fructose corn syrup with our tax dollars? Why are school lunches, right? Why does it have to be so highly processed, so stimulating, so that it conditions these kids' neural pathways for a lifetime? It doesn't have to be that way. When we were growing up, certainly, I mean, we ate real food. The food we're eating today is, in essence, it's adult baby food.
You suggest the food industry's entire business model, as you said, is built on catering to and encouraging this hyper-eating, and the food that we're getting, sugar, salt, fat, layering of this food, is the problem. What's the reaction you've been getting from fast food companies, from the food industry generally, since you published your book?
Their business model has been to take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it available 24/7, add the emotional gloss of advertising, make it into entertainment.
But what's been the response to your book, to your work, to your allegations?
It's fascinating, Jane. Absolute silence. Absolute silence. No comment whatsoever.
Here's Hillary. She's in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hillary, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. I just have a couple of things. Earlier on in the conversation, I was struck by Dr. Kessler was talking about, sort of in a very negative way, thinking about food constantly, thinking about one's next meal. And I was thinking about when I lived in Paris for a year when I was 19, and I thought about food all the time. And I went to bed thinking about the wonderful butter that would be served at breakfast. And my time there was very much focused on food and enjoying my food. And I gained some weight, but I couldn't have been happier and healthier. And I think that's what's missing from this conversation when you talk about fat, sugar, and salt as sort of this axis of evil almost. Fat, sugar, and salt aren't in themselves bad. The issue is the type of fat and the quantity of the fat. Olive oil, as we know, is one of the most healthy foods on the planet. And so I think the issue is really more about the quality of the food that we're eating. And number two, I think it's possible and I think it's good to crave food and to be that it's possible to both crave and be satiated by food in a healthful way. And I don't think that should be, you know, almost demonized. I mean, food should be pleasure and food can also be health. And that's what Alice Waters talks about. That's what Michael Pollan talks about. So when we talk about, when we take it all down to, you know, fat, sugar, salt, and calories, we're not hearing at all about the positive aspects of food and the positive aspects of eating, both for pleasure and for health.
Hillary, thank you so much. It's a good point. The quality of the food. She thinks this is too simplified. Dr. Kessler?
Alice Waters, Michael Pollan, they are talking about the pleasures of food, but they're talking about real food. Food has to be enjoyable. It has to be pleasurable. It's not going to work, right, if we deprive ourselves. The thoughts that I am talking about are the preoccupations, the obsessions, where people are struggling with the control over their eating. And the more you think about it, right, that only reinforces, that amplifies the reward values. And I'm talking, those thoughts aren't very pleasant for people because they don't like what they're doing because they're not in control of what they're eating. And I agree with Hillary. A movement back toward real foods, food that's pleasurable, food that can sustain you, that can nourish you. That's what we need to be doing. She's exactly right.
You mentioned the writer Michael Pollan. He says that Americans actually spend less on food than they did 50 years ago and more on health care. In fact, here are the numbers that I looked up. In the 50s, Americans spent 18% of their budget on food, 8% on health care. Now it's just the opposite. Americans spend about 18% on health care and about 8 to 9% on food. Have Americans exchanged cheap food for expensive health care and, in some cases, terrible health, Dr. Kessler?
I think it's a wonderful, important point. But understand the compulsions, the obsessions, the fact that we've made food into entertainment, the wanting, the drive, this cycle of consumption that people find themselves in. I think if people start eating real foods, foods that are going to sustain themselves, that's one of the greatest ways we can get out of this cycle. Mm. If we look at that fat, sugar, and salt, that highly processed food, and you wonder whether there's any real food in that, and you think that's going to make you feel better, that's what you want. We're never going to change. We have to change how America looks at food. And that may mean spending a little more on food that's going to sustain us, on real food.
Here's David. He's calling from Lancaster, Wisconsin. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Dr. Kessler, you said the magic word earlier, and it was corn syrup. We need to see the documentary, Corn is King, The Rise of Type 2 Diabetes, Parallels, the rise of the introduction of corn syrup into the food industry starting in the 1970s. I think you need to reframe the conversation away from sugar, more to corn syrup. It is widely available. It is much cheaper than sugar, and it is synthetic, whereas sugar is natural. Our bodies can break that down, but not corn syrup. So that's what I'd ask you to do in the future, is to pay more attention to corn syrup, and I challenge people to read their labels on corn syrup. You'll be amazed.
David, thank you. Dr. Kessler, response.
David raises a very good point. Whether it's sugar or whether it's corn syrup, that sweetness stimulates, it activates the brain. Mm. That wide use of corn syrup, no doubt, has contributed to the excessive activation of the brains of millions of Americans. It's a real, real problem.
Diana is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Diana, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I'm a rising third-year medical student. I'll start seeing patients on Monday, actually. Mm. And we fit in a very cursory nutrition program in my medical school in between all our other courses. But mm-hmm. I have pretty much no idea, as a primary care physician or a cardiologist, how I will help patients to approach this problem. And I don't really know where in medical training that information is going to come. I know that when I finish and have my degree, that I have sort of an obligation to throw that weight around in terms of lobbying and farm bills and school lunch. But how is it that physicians should be taking a role with their patients individually, whether you're a pediatrician or you're dealing with geriatrics? Mm. I'll take my answer off the air.
Diana, great question. Thanks for calling. Dr. Kessler.
Diana hits a point very close to home. You know, as a physician, where have we been? Millions and millions of our patients are presenting with this conditioned hypereating where they come in, right? They have a hard time controlling their eating. They're thinking about foods in a negative way, not in a positive way. They're struggling with their weight. We spend this minute or two maybe talking about them. You know, we tell them to go on a diet, but diets are not going to work. We have not been listening to what's going on. We have not understood as a profession how the brain has been rewired in these millions of Americans.
So is it
most importantly, we haven't given them the tools. Mm. We haven't explained to them what's going on with them. We haven't given them the tools. They don't feel good about themselves. The medical profession, we've been AWOL on this issue.
It's up to primary care doctors then, I guess, to join the fight?
It's up to all of us to join the fight, to understand, now that we have the science, now that we understand, you know, it's not your fault that if you have a hard time controlling, you know, these desires, these thoughts of wanting, this excessive eating, But we have to give people the tools. We have to show them how they can cool their stimulus. We have to show them the diets are not going to work, that they really are going to have to change their relationship with food, and it's not going to be the stuff of sound bites or of instant miracle fixes.
I've only got about a minute left in this hour, Dr. Kessler. What's the most surprising thing you learned during your investigation for this book?
I thought where I was heading when I wanted to understand the struggle with weight was into the fields of physiology and endocrinology and bariatrics and nutrition. Where I found myself was in the fundamental questions of what makes us human, how our brains work, how we respond to our environment. The fact is, this condition, hypereating, it's not a disease. It's the way our brains are worked, but we're being bombarded constantly with food cues. And we have to be able to change our environments in the way we look at food.
Dr. David Kessler joining us this hour from San Francisco. His new book is The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Former commissioner of the FDA, during his time at the FDA, led the campaign to regulate tobacco. Now in the fight against bad food. Dr. Kessler, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jane.
Appreciate it. You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.